Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your yellow-veined pal-not-so of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonico. The year, it's over. It's done. I see you, Karen. I see you. It is attempt three to record the Mailbag Podcast. We have been defied and violently manhandled at every turn by Joe's Wi-Fi, even though he denies it. But we are here to cradle you, to swaddle you in your year-end quiet moments. I have to say, I hope you are enjoying some time off. I hope you're with loved ones. And I mean people who are not simply us, because we are beloved, we know. The whole gang is back, and we have overcome a number of tribulations to be here today. Karen, recently on vacation, back on the couch, back with Richard, her cat.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, don't get it twisted.
Don't get it twisted.
Karen does not live with a man named Richard.
Definitely not.
Don't confuse the masses.
Absolutely. Karen, how was your trip?
It was great. You know, I love to see my parents.
Eli and Geraldine.
That is correct. Amazing.
Shout out to Eli and Geraldine. Yo, do Eli and Geraldine, do they listen to podcasts?
They listen to podcast when I am a guest on podcast.
That's a choice. That's certainly a choice.
They did create.
Well, if they're listening to this episode, we say hi. We wish you well. And also, we'd like to say the podcast has a lot to offer, even when Karen's not on podcast. So feel free to join us at any other time.
I know they're close readers of the section, even if they are not close listeners.
That is accurate. I see the notes.
We really appreciate their continued clicks and support.
Absolutely. But also feel free to listen to us even when Karen is elsewhere, where we remain here. So shout out to Del Boca Vista. Joe, what haven't you overcome to be here today?
I was sick when we first started trying to record this podcast. Now I feel much better, but I was going to do the mailbag no matter what. And my Wi-Fi speeds at home are fire, according to speed tests. And yet, you know, blocked. So here I do want to say, back in the New York Times office.
When we did speed test, when we remained baffled about what was happening, it turned out that the person with the most trash speed was me, which is insane considering what I pay Verizon Fios every month. But it turns out that I have the trash speeds, but nevertheless, still managed to pull through. We're glad that you're better, and hopefully whatever healed you can also heal your Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I'm ready, and I hope I will be podcasting from home again in the new year.
Next year in Brooklyn Heights, as they say. Let's get right into it. I want to talk just for a quick second about the Discord, because I was gathering questions from email, as you know, the Facebook group, Discord, disgruntled friends of mine, and so on and so forth. There is a good conversation happening in the Discord, in the mailbag channel, between Satu and Lauren. Satu has emailed us previously from a few mailbags ago. You may remember, submitted a question, I believe a Taylor related question that was very advanced placement, and we've got a lot of convo going. They're having a great conversation about gender dynamics, Harry Styles, Bad Bunny, terms of masculinity in pop music, and it was really refreshing to see, and I hope everybody joins that, and you know, it heartens me that those conversations are happening on the Discord. Get involved with that, tinyurl.com/podcast Discord. First question. It's coming from Nicole Weinstein, and there's a name in this question that I got to be honest, I was surprised to see.
Were you?
I was. I was. It was an old name.
An old friend who I hadn't heard from in a while.
And so let's just get into it and talk about how some friendships fade and others don't. Nicole says, we've seen the stagnation of hits this year alongside a lack of new artists breaking. Even just last year, we saw Olivia Rodrigo break in a way that hasn't really been replicated since, despite her sound and overall style still being popular. Interesting twist. What do you think gets us out of this, so to speak, rut we're in with new artists breaking? Is it a new type of pop star or style of genre, an entirely new music ecosystem? Just a matter of time. How do you see new artists breaking in the current TikTok era of the music industry when everyone's streaming services and social media pages are so niche and personalized? I'm going to just go ahead and say it. I did not hear anything from Olivia Rodrigo in 2022. After hearing nothing but Olivia Rodrigo in 2021, I understand that people like Adele, Frank Ocean, they disappear, they stoke interest. I don't know if they reimagine themselves, but they regenerate themselves and then they come back. I wonder if that is the right move for someone at Olivia's stage of career.
Let me briefly correct the record because I had time to remind myself. Not only did we review her tour, Olivia was on tour for the first time this year.
Yeah, what that was like when?
That was early in the year.
Good tour.
Yes, great tour. Yeah, I was looking back at my videos. But okay, in addition to
shout
that.
Shout out to my friends in Portland, where I reviewed that tour.
Great tour, Veruca Salt cover. But I'm assuming that also means that you missed my viral tweet about her appearance at MSG singing Uptown Girl with Billy Joel. Is that true? I think it's
and
true.
And he also missed the aggregation of said yes. tweet by multiple music news outlets.
I'm just going to go ahead and say, yes, I missed your viral tweet. And I hope that we'll that's let that not, go. I hope that's not reflected in my performance review.
John had a great year, except, yeah.
Needs to set tweet alerts for my tweets. Okay, so you had a viral tweet about Olivia Rodrigo.
That's not about me, John. It's about Olivia.
Performing with a septuagenarian. That's great. That's a big year. So what you're saying is what Olivia did this year is toured. It was reviewed by me in Portland, Oregon, and was tweeted by you. That's the
That's
entire
all I'm
year.
Saying. That's
the
my entire correction. Year.
Joe, is that enough?
Look, I actually think that Olivia's strategy is extremely shrewd, and I wish more stars would take note of this. I think being in your face when you have something to promote, when you have something you believe in, is great, and then making yourself scarce and creating the opportunity to return with some sense of excitement is something, frankly, I think more artists could take note of. I think what you saw a lot this year was, yes, stagnation, but also a few big names hoarding a lot of the oxygen up top. Beyoncé, Harry Styles, Drake put out two albums. I think it was tough for anything to break through for a variety of reasons, which I think we'll get into. But I actually feel like Olivia's playbook is one that will work moving forward, given just how much we're all trying to deal with media-wise at any given moment.
Given what you just said, Joe, I would like to take this opportunity to announce that I, too, will be taking a 6 to 9 month sabbatical while still collecting income, but with the understanding that the regeneration of my time and my energy is actually of paramount importance, that I can return, I don't know, like August or September at full strength. Karen, you're signing off on that, right?
Very interesting.
Yeah.
And when you come
she's
back,
nodding. She's nodding.
Yes.
Yeah. When you come back, the single better be banging.
No lie was told. Okay. So I am concerned though, because, and this may be a function of my consumption habits, which are, what's the word? Juvenile. They're juvenile, my consumption habits. They're toddler-like.
I was going to say obsessive. Go on.
Yeah. I mean, like, definitely like an unwell 12-year-old is how I consume media. And so I am constantly looking for a little bit of like... And my understanding of popular culture, music-driven popular culture at this moment is extremely small spark. And do some of those things lead to bigger sparks or bigger fires? Yes, absolutely. But I, as sort of an observer, am eminently at peace with a whole year of tiny sparks. Olivia no longer really has that option to do a bunch of small stuff. But I do worry that in an ecosystem that's increasingly oriented towards that kind of consumption, this thing about waiting for the big drop, I don't know. I'm not sure it's sound.
But it might be healthier because you think of these artists who are trying to stay in the spotlight constantly, and it seems to really wear on them, especially the younger artists. But I do want to pivot to the core of the question, which is, what will it take for us to get new sounds and new stars? I think this year was really a liminal period in a lot of ways. We've seen, you know, stories in the trade press about the decline of playlists as a launching pad, the decline of TikTok, that it might give a spark to a certain hit, but it's not really making artists' careers. And I think us and the industry have been trying to figure this out all year. And there's a few explanations. I think the amount of media that is on streaming is drowning things out. And this goes across mediums.
Yeah, this is happening
in television. This is happening in film. This is happening in podcasts. There are not a lot of hits, period, across the board. But I think that something we share is that we love subculture and we love monoculture. And we especially love when we can see subculture bubbling up into the mainstream. And while I think subculture is really healthy right now, and there are a ton of little niches that are fun to follow, not a lot of them are catching into a full flame and then transcending into sort of household name status. And I think that's what a lot of people are missing. And I don't know how we get back there.
I don't think we do. Like, I genuinely don't think that's an option anymore. And I think even someone like Olivia, who certainly is the closest we've had to like a big tent cross demographic, cross scene pop star.
Yeah, an old school rise.
And also was reverse integrated into the cool kids. Like basically started out fairly centrist and then cool kids were kind of like, yeah, we like her too. We want her. We're going to put her in weird clothes and we're going to like make her interesting. We haven't seen that in a really long time. In a strange way, the question actually has me thinking a lot about SZA, who also went away for a really long time. And I think did not do the thing that I'm saying Olivia Rodrigo should do, but almost like her refusal, like there was a publicness to her refusal to do the things, which in and of itself becomes a thing and part of a narrative that you can thread through her absence.
Right. It's a protest almost,
yes,
against the contours of modern stardom.
But you're still showing up. Like it's like you're showing up to protest. You know, it's like the real version of all those like bullshit TikToks from like Florence and the Machine or whatever about like, nah, I can't believe they're making me be on TikTok.
Or Halsey was one of the big ones this year.
Right. Yeah. Where it's just like, you did sign up to be famous. I regret to inform you. This is actually part of the job.
How do you explain the SZA Maroon 5 song in that conversation?
Label pressure.
As I say, in uncomfortable situations, Cara Monica declined to comment.
But do you guys think we're going to see, like, was this just a bum year or is everything just niche now? And we're just going to have to get used to, you know, and we've touched on this idea in our coverage over the last few years of the sort of rise of like the alt star, right? Like somebody who is huge in their universe, but who has no sort of like man on the street awareness. Even Bad Bunny, to some extent, is that kind of star where he can sell out multiple nights at Yankee Stadium. And yet, like, what is the Bad Bunny song that everybody knows? Like, I don't know.
It's Iti Me Pregunto, Jesus, Joe.
What do Karen's parents know about Bad Bunny?
They're in Florida. I hope they know a lot. Eli, Geraldine, can you email in and tell us what the Bad Bunny representation is in Del Boca Vista, please?
One of their friends actually did ask me about him when I arrived there in Florida. He said, let's talk about Benito. So there you go.
Wow.
So it's working, but maybe the answer is that it just takes much longer because SZA, like if this is the album where SZA becomes super enmeshed in the A-list household name, it took a while. So maybe it's going to happen fewer amount of times and it's going to take longer to happen. I don't know.
Let's do the counterpoint. This is not a question from a listener, but it is something that I'm thinking about as we're having this conversation. How do we square the kind of opposite problem here of incredibly huge artists this past year who kind of dropped projects that absolutely came and went? Obviously, I'm thinking of The Weeknd. I'm thinking to a certain degree of Drake, at least the first of the two Drake albums.
Post Malone.
Totally forgot Post Malone. But yeah, seriously. Really?
Kendrick Lamar.
Wow. Seriously. So you have these artists who literally have to support the music at this point in their career is essentially a support act for the touring business and for like the fame business, right? Like The Weeknd played stadiums this year. Drake, I assume, will come back and have an arena tour or maybe even some stadium shows. And yet these records had no traction whatsoever. Is that the kind of flip side of the question that's being asked here? Not only are we not in a position to imprint a new star cross demographically, but also old stars no longer have the hold on those channels that they had even 2, 3, 4 years ago.
I think it's really just a question of how sticky the songs are. I mean, Olivia got very popular off of the song. That was the definitive song. And it crossed, you know, it was a monoculture song. SZA is completely different because I think of her more of an album artist. And the album is really good. Now, all the albums we just mentioned that didn't do so great, they weren't all terrible, but I can't name the hit off of any of them. I think there was just like a hit desert this year.
I mean, that was the other thing. Like Jimmy Cooks, it was a hit. But even when you guys were running down the Billboard Hot 100 number ones in the singles of the year episode, like that is a bleak year. And I think the industry, from the conversations I had on the record and off, like people are really scratching their heads. And there is a bit of a crisis in these major label buildings about where are the hits and where are the stars. Now, I think that there's a flip side where, like for John, for someone like you, you love all these little sparks online, and you can critically, I think it's a really interesting time if you're willing to engage and meet people on their own terms. But when you look at it from a business perspective and from a mainstream perspective of people saying, you know, where's my next Olivia Rodrigo? Like there really is a dearth. Look, maybe this is where we get Nirvana, you know, maybe this is where we get like somebody to really come in.
You mean destroy Lonely? Like you're telling me that we're going to big 2023 for the opium lifestyle? Like, is that what we're talking about here?
Maybe it's rage music. Maybe it's, you know, still, maybe it's still pop punk. Maybe, you know, I don't know. I don't know. But I'm ready because I think we have this in common. Like we love when stuff bubbles up and then all of a sudden the center is shifted.
I think that that's totally fair. And it also has me thinking a little bit about another person who had a, dare I say, an off year. And that's our friend Taylor Swift. Yeah.
Interesting take.
And yet hugely popular.
Exactly. Successful hugely popular. Year. But again, an album in service of the touring business. And like a
I don't love Midnights, but I would say that Antihero is in the same way as Break My Soul and to a lesser extent Cuff It from Beyonce. These songs are like old fashioned. These are like 10 years ago hits from these artists. Like these are radio smashes.
Well, I am so glad that you brought that up because that leads perfectly into our next question. Joe, we have been at this for a long time, you and I. I for a longer time.
Which
you.
Part?
All of us. Just this thing of ours. This thing of ours.
Karen has way more years in the game than I do. Let's be clear.
But specifically for this, for the purposes of this question.
Okay.
You and I, we have a perspective. We have a take. We have an opinion. We have a framework. I have had this framework for a very long time. You have had this framework for a long time. And finally, the question has arrived where I firmly believe all of our hard work is not for naught. Here's the question. It's from Gabe Gill. Gabe says, I value Youngboy Never Broke Again immensely as a songwriter and vocalist, but his rapid album releases have made me shift into a certain mode of listening to his music. When he puts out an album or a few, I pick through and consolidate my favorites into playlists. I find his projects enjoyable, but usually flawed, too long, or too uneven. With Taylor Swift's prodigious releases of so much music in the past few years, I feel like she is in some way attempting to shift her audience into appreciating her music this way. I don't enjoy Midnights as an album at all the way that I do a project like 1989 or Reputation, but I can pick songs for Midnights, Folkmore, the two Taylor's versions, and have a wealth of songs I enjoy from the past few years of Taylor. Do you think this is purposeful? Is Taylor using the album format more as a vehicle for her wealth of material and less as a themed, concise message? Is she genuinely generating this much material and having a hard time shaping the package or era around it? I am done. I did it.
It's over.
Incredible. I have no notes.
Yeah, the project is over. Oh, look, we've made this case in various forms and formats. Musicians respond to the technology available to them. Music was a singles business when 7 inches were what was available.
The dominant transmission format. Yeah.
Right. Then they make LPs, and then an album becomes a capital A album becomes the thing that we measure against. And of course, usually these are dictated by, you know, white executives.
And profit concerns. I mean, this, you know,
and profit concerns.
Yeah, of course.
And we are in a playlist era. These, I think Taylor, more than most, wants to have it both ways. She loves albums. She thinks of her albums thematically. They all tell a story. They all have a palette visually and orally, you know. But I do think that it would be foolish to think somebody as savvy as Taylor Swift is not also thinking about the fact that people can do that. They can build their own albums, as the three of us have done with the last few Taylor projects, you know, even going back to Lover. This is how music is consumed these days. And I think, it would be foolish to think that the artists are not aware of that.
I have on occasion in record reviews referred to albums as data dumps. Increasingly, they feel like that. I think the Post Malone, Ray Schremerd double album review from maybe 3 years
ago?
Endless
streaming.
Yeah. Like the idea that an album, and again, I would even dispute, shout out to all my rockist friends on Twitter, I would even dispute the notion that like there was some pure thing about the quote unquote album outside of like a few artists. Generally, I mean, even if you're thinking of the CD era, I mean, an album was just like a bunch of songs on a disc that cost 9 cents to produce and cost $20 to purchase. But to me, I feel like albums have increasingly, and especially hip hop records, you know, you look at old Migos records, Thug records, Future records. I mean, the idea to clog playlists and then aggregate those songs into album format, that's the playbook. I mean, we've talked previously on Popcast and Joe about that QC interview where either, I forget if it's Coach K or P, just basically talks about
market share.
Market share. Like every week there's a new playlist. We've got to be on there every week, like no matter what. Like we have to have 1, 2, 3 songs. We're going to be near the top. That's the business we're in. The album is a secondary concern, especially for internet focused or youth focused musicians. So, yeah, do I think that Youngboy is doing this intentionally? Of course, Youngboy. This is, of course, what Youngboy is doing. And as for Taylor, I'm a little more skeptical. I do think she might be running out of like a big picture idea, even though we offer them continually on this show. We could do an entire...
Offer them for her.
Yeah, for her. Like we could just do a second episode every week of like how to amplify Taylor's second career phase or third career phase. But I do think, so I'm a little skeptical of this in regards to Taylor. I do think some of it is like maybe running out of like a theme idea. Karen, what do you make of the kind of argument that Taylor is thinking in these terms, like kind of knowing in advance that people are going to cherry pick the stuff that they like?
Taylor is an album artist. I'm skeptical of this theory. However, Midnights is an album. And then those 7 lesser songs that she dumped at the end of it, that to me is her concession to this idea. I don't feel like those were true artistic parts of this album. I think that was, and if we add 7 songs, maybe people will stream the album longer and whatever, we'll get more money from that. But to me, I don't see Taylor like breaking out of the album construct. I think that is the type of songwriter she is, the type of artist she is, the way she thinks, as you both said before, about things in complete projects with color schemes, aesthetics, Easter eggs, whatever. I don't see that going away for her. So I'm going to agree and disagree.
Even in the dumps, like a song we didn't focus on, we talked about Midnights, Could Have, Would Have, Should Have, really did take on a life of its own and really has legs among Taylor fans. And it basically only exists, as you say, you know, as a song for playlists. Now, then there's like going back to like, where are the stars? Like there is the oversaturation question and the how much time is being spent trying to maximize these songs as songwriting. And like a young boy, I did the napkin math, actually, because I was just curious a couple of days ago. I think Youngboy put out 150 plus songs this year. Like, remember, like in peak Wayne era, you know, shout out to Sean Fennessy. Like, I think there, it was like
one of my best vibe 2-page spreads.
And it was what, 88? The best 77. 88?
The 77 best Lil Wayne songs of 2007. It's on my Twitter if anybody wants to see it.
A classic, but I'm a Youngboy fan and I need somebody to do the ranking all 150 plus Youngboy songs of 2022 because I don't even know where to start.
Is this an assignment?
Yes, it's an assignment. Jason, get on it.
I thought for me.
No, I mean, yeah, look, if you have a free week, like I would love to read it.
Can you imagine?
Like, I need the Cliff's Notes, you know, like I need the primer because I'm old.
That's inaccurate, but I understand what you're saying. But that is
okay. But let me rephrase, because I'm tired.
Yes. Okay. No argument there. We're going to take a quick break. We've been talking a lot about pop punk, a lot about emo this year, but you and I, we both know the only real emo rock star is NBA Youngboy. So here's Emo Rockstar off of Colors.
Rock beats on my face. I got big, big lows on the way. I got bundles of blue honey. I won't take my paint off. Just wanna be free, so tell them please take these links off. My heart shackled down. Kill me if they can't take my head off.
I read this article in the New York Times
about the Me Too movement in Iran.
About saffron dryers, like a village that dries saffron.
I just found it to be so visually beautiful.
Once I started reading, I just was completely captivated.
It really felt that I was turning the lights on.
The New York Times keeps me curious.
And that's what I love about it.
Find out how the New York Times can fit into your life
at nytimes.com/life.
We're back. Joe's here. Karen's here. More questions are here. LFG. We did get a lot of Taylor questions. We did just have a Taylor mailbag. I'm not going to dwell too much on Taylor. Also, I want to acknowledge the email from Luke, no last name provided, who said, P.S. after some other questions. Love you, but please, can we get a Taylor embargo this episode? I can't bear to hear any more about it.
Sorry.
Have mercy.
Yo, Luke, check the stats on our Taylor episodes.
999% more popular than the average podcast episode.
If you only knew.
Seriously.
You know?
This is like our version of a label exec meeting where we're telling the artist, yeah, we absolutely understand you want to like do an album full of integrity and like acoustic productions that you record like in the fjords of Norway where the sound is crystal pure. But really, can you just quickly go in the studio with like Sam Smith and just like knock this thing out and just be done? Yeah. So we can have one hit and then you can get your ass to the fjords and spend a week there. Like,
yeah, when Karen tells us we need a single, she means a Taylor Swift episode.
That's exactly right. And we are here to provide. We are pop focused. I'm pop focused, man. Okay, so I'm largely going to skip Taylor discourse, but there is one question that I am going to share because it came in just after the last mailbag, and it made me laugh so loud that I have to share it. This is coming in from Daniel Roseberry. Shout out Daniel in Paris. Daniel says, I had a question while listening to Midnights. That was something I also thought when I was listening to Casey Musgraves' last album, Starcrossed. Is this music made by artists who are smoking weed throughout the process of recording? The heady Yes, Joe. That is an exact replica of the look that I made. The heady expansiveness, the washed out stack vocals. Shout out washed out. Miss you. The lack of specificity in the lyrics all point to things that sound stimulating and satisfying while stoned. I wouldn't know. Also, the randomness of the imagery and the ambivalence of some of the emotions. Never mind that the Midnights cover looks like Taylor's about to light a joint. Is that true?
I agree.
All right. Compared to Taylor's other work, which feels incomparably sharper, accurate, more precise, accurate, and even with more narrative arc, also accurate. Similarly, Golden Hour was Casey's psychedelic album, and it felt really, quote, clear. Are we in Taylor's stoner phase? Absolutely no judgment on smoking, but curious if you think it could be what muddled the intention and acuity of the record. Huge fan of the show.
This is so good. Why are these questions so good?
Huge fan of the show. Thank you for taking Taylor's work seriously. Wow. We seriously appreciate this question. Look, I'm famously not a drug user, famously not a weed smoker. Famously. So
yeah, it sounds like you're being sarcastic, but I just want to be clear. You're being 100%
totally
earnest.
Totally earnest. So Lord knows what. I've certainly listened to plenty of music designed to be listened to.
Have you heard Revolver?
No. Actually,
have you heard Purple Haze?
Yes. To be fair, yes. To be fair, yes.
But you haven't heard.
I haven't heard Purple Haze. What do we think about this? Taylor, she's hitting the advanced glassware. Like she has a crazy Japanese glassware collection in the loft in Tribeca.
Karen,
hilarious.
As my guy Cam says, I get zooted and write down my problems. Is that what Taylor's doing?
Amazing.
I feel like it would have shown up in the lyrics, you know, like we got so many whiskeys and Manhattans and pour me another drinks on the last few albums. I don't know why she wouldn't have brought it up.
First of all, Zach Sokol, get on the case. Decode the weed. Decode this hidden weed references on Midnights, please.
Look, what if every time she says incense, which is way too many times, she means marijuana?
Damn.
Okay, that's funny.
Okay, look, I love this theory. I think there's something to it. I think Midnights sounds better when you're stoned. I think that's like a Jack Antonoff production layers synth thing. I don't really think of Jack as like a stoner, either literally or like aesthetically, but I think that there's overlap there. I like the sort of historical long view of imagine in 10 years somebody writing like a college thesis about how like the end of marijuana prohibition dovetails with this murkier sound from Taylor. But I would say that I think like lack of specificity, that's where you sort of lose me. I think if this was a stoned album, the lyrics would be more specific, not less.
Like specific, but bizarre. Like specific, not in a traditional Taylor way.
Yeah, I think she would be fixated on different things, maybe. But look, I love the idea. I think it's a really inspired thought exercise.
I've had a lot of time to think about this question because it came in so long ago. So it's been on my mind. I'm just going to say it's a non-zero chance. It's non-zero. It's not 20% likely, but it's not zero. I do think that the looseness of this record does not specifically feel tied to what we have come to think of as like the intensity of Taylor's workflow. I feel like getting back when the album came out, we see the kind of gaps in the songwriting, we see the imperfections, and knowing that Taylor like allowed those imperfections out into the world, or maybe didn't even identify them as imperfections.
But now we know that she was writing a movie that she's planning to direct in the next year, over the last year, too. So maybe she was just doing too much, multitasking.
The other environmental thing that we know about the writing and recording of this album is that it was also tied to Jack and Taylor's partners making a movie together, and which no one saw, but shout out to Margaret Qualley and that other guy.
Are you not shouting out Joe, the other Joe?
We don't claim him.
Okay.
Bill Barrow?
Yeah, Bill. Big Bill.
Wait, did that movie come out? Like, true story.
I feel like Edie
Falco with the Avatar thing where it's dog. Yeah. I just straight up did not know it came out. I thought it came out and flopped.
I saw the trailer and I did not rush to remember the release date. But so they were on location, I believe, for at least some of this. I don't know exactly where, so I don't know what the marijuana laws are in that exact place. But given how long it took Taylor to start talking about drinking, even after her 21st birthday, I think that the answer will be if she talks about smoking weed on the next album.
Yeah, or like two to three albums from now. Like there's going to be like a duet with Willie Nelson on like album three, like three albums from now. Like, you know, yeah.
May
yeah.
he continue to be with us.
Smoking on my Swift pack.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of people who have smoked on various X-packs. When Taylor Swift discovers the various puns she can make.
It's such rich material. Yo, honestly, again, as a non-smoker, but like smoking on my X-pack, yeah. About that life.
SZA Taylor coming in 2023.
Please, like literally, if Phoebe first, Taylor second.
Yeah. You guys like that Phoebe verse? I think that song works.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. One more Taylor adjacent question.
Oh, wow. We're really.
No. We're okay. Just lightly adjacent. This is a quickie. Okay. It's from Bryson Schmidt. Bryson says, after hearing the new 1975 album, I can't help but ask, is Jack Antonoff putting Taylor, Lord, and Lana in a box? Or is it the other way around?
I feel like we've addressed this so many times.
Spicy.
You guys go. I've talked about this. I can only relay what these artists have told me, and I feel like I've done that on Popcast. So you guys go.
Karen, talk about the 1975 album, and what do you think? Is Jack successful on that record?
I don't think I am the person to talk about the 1975 album.
You're the only one that went to the show. Wait, Joe, did you go to the show?
No, Karen watched it on Amazon.com.
Is that true?
Yeah, I did because I couldn't make it in person and I was curious. Fantastic art piece.
Kill myself.
Really interesting. Very weird.
You like that they were trying. And that's what I like about the 1975.
Complete respect for the trying. I think they did get a little too jackified on that album. So I'm not going to let Jack off the hook.
Okay. I think them doing a Jack thing is actually like a really interesting compromise point for that band, which kind of can be all over the place, I find. You know, I think this is the first 1975 album that I like fully connected with. And I think probably part of that is the continuity that Jack provided.
And I think that was a very conscious decision on the band's behalf. I talked to Matty Healy about it in the same way that I've talked to Lord about working with Jack. I've talked to Taylor about working with Jack. I've talked to Claro about working with Jack. You know, and these artists are very adamant that, like, and these are some of the most popular and powerful artists in the world. Like, they do what they want, and what they want is to work with Jack Antonoff. Then what he does from there in terms of reining them in or indulging their excesses, that is up for debate. And I think it's interesting the place that Jack holds in the pop music conversation. I think nobody, you know, there are a lot of guys who are on a lot of albums every year, you know, and that don't get talked about in the same way that Jack does. I think in part because he's made himself a public figure, in part because he has such definable tics and interests and traits. I think it continues to be an interesting conversation, but I can't abide by the narrative that he is somehow in control here, because I just know it to not be true.
My only note on that is sometimes I think, and this could be true in life, this could be true in art, in business, in friendship, in romance, whatever, like you're presented with an idea of yourself or of your capacities or your boundaries by a circumstance. And you like that version of yourself and you're like, okay, I can return to that version of myself time and again and feel good about it. But you're not expanding it. You're not pushing beyond it. You're not reaching outward. And so I don't think Jack is like in the studio, like task mastering and be like, no, don't be more interesting. Don't be more unusual. Don't stretch it. But I do think it might create a rhythm of work that would exclude the potential for something more expansive. And that comfort, it's not that they're returning to Jack for that specific sound. They might be returning to Jack for the comfort. And, you know, this is something we talked about with Taylor a bunch about a kind of like growing resistance to risk. These might be artists who have arrived at a place in their career where their risk resistance is growing and Jack is the level at which they have stopped.
Except that, and the flip side of that is that I think they see what they're doing as the real risk. I think Jack's production is so bespoke. I think his tastes are wide, even if the sounds are not, and he's down to try. And I think that, like, when you look at what Lorde did on her latest Jack Antonoff produced album, or even the one before that, Melodrama, or what Claro did, which was a total pivot from the direction she had been heading. And even the 1975 got tighter and got narrower in sound, but I still think that they see it as experimentation, and that, and Jack is the one letting them unfurl in this way. And Lana too. I think Lana's albums have gotten weirder as she's become more entrenched with Jack as her producer. So I don't know that they see it as safety, but it can come to feel safe when it's the thing that they all have in common.
Fair. Fair. I accept it, just with a light asterisk. Karen, this one is for you. Never seen a more Ganscore question in many years of mailbag episodes. This is from Spencer Glesby. Spencer says, I was wondering what your guys' thoughts were about the surfeit of great indie rock albums this year, with some bigger name artists putting out their pandemic albums, The Beths, Wise Blood, Aldous Harding, Alex G, Soccer Mommy, Niloufer Yanya, Angel Olsen, Florist, Mitski, Always, Julia Jacklin, and other newer artists making a big splash, Wet Leg, Grace Ives. I'm missing like 30 other bands, but you get the point, et cetera, et cetera. Would you define 2022 as an indie rock resurgence? Do you think it will stick? / will music publications ever focus on indie rock the same way they did in the early 2010s? Or are we on the full-blown poptimism train? Karen.
Well, I'm going to say Karen, something so wildly rock, unpopular.
Is indie rock
yeah, go
back?
In, Karen.
Is indie
go
rock
in.
Back?
I didn't think that those albums were that great.
Oh!
You take served.
Yo, you got served, Spencer. I'm so sorry. I was setting you
Karen,
up for victory.
Karen is only on the Renaissance train.
Wow. Karen.
I did like Renaissance.
No,
but
more guitars.
Yo.
Karen again said it.
Karen, I'm go speak on it.
No, I don't want to.
Wash this.
I'm not going to devalue the question. I think that a lot of those records were very, very good. And I saw a lot of extreme appreciation for them. They got a lot of attention. I think some of them were interesting. But I was not really moved by any of those ones that were mentioned, to be honest with you.
TBH.
Well,
but this
echoes to me most of like the early 2000s, even early 2010s, when there was just like a ton of interesting or like, you know, pretty good indie rock records coming out every year, but none of them were like giant breakouts. So to me, it felt more like that.
I want to comment on the poptimism part of that question, because I don't know about you guys, but when I'm looking at year-end lists, it looks like this band called Always was Beyonce.
I knew you were going to say that.
Look, I mean,
okay, can I just is anyone done the like Always but it's never with two V's? Like, has anybody done that? Has anybody done that?
That's our side project.
Karen, I know you like that band. I'm sorry.
I do like that band, but I didn't think it was the album of the year.
We did a nice story about that band. Karen, you edited. I listened to it when it came out. I thought it was good and fuzzy and in the realm of things that I liked when all music sounded like that. And I listened to it again as it got all these plaudits and like, nice album. But look, I don't know how to put this and not seem a little snarky, but I think we're actually entering a phase where you no longer have to pretend
to like indie rock.
The opposite. You no longer have to pretend to be a poptimist or to be a raptimist. You know, you don't, like, people have pretty much given up pretend because of these various niches and subgenres, and because there's so much music coming out and it's so hard to follow. Like, you don't have to pretend like you're into Youngboy. You could just listen to your Always album if you're like a music fan or critic on the internet, and that's fine. Like, everybody do your own thing. But like, I don't think we should pretend, you know, that it's not like that, that these albums and these songs, I mean, the New Yorker, you know, doesn't run a lot of music features every year. And I think if you look back at who they have covered over the last 2 years, like, it's a lot of these type of artists that were named. You know, I think there's like plenty of shine, you know, from the NPRs, the Stereo Gums, the Pitchforks of the world.
And again, a disproportionate shine in keeping with,
you said it.
Yeah, disproportionate shine in keeping with the tastes and backgrounds of a lot of the media class. You know, that's worrisome. It's the kind of thing that I hated in 1993 or 1998 or 2005. It's part of why I frame my critical practice the way that I do in reaction to something like this. I actually have a sort of an opposite or maybe a complementary perspective to both yours, which is, I wasn't moved, frankly, by a lot of these records. There are a couple in here that I think are okay. Wasn't totally moved. A bunch of these records, I think, are the lesser records of some of these artists. This is a lesser Soccer Mommy record. This is a lesser Wise Blood record. This is a lesser Angel Olsen record, lesser Mitski record. I think indie rock has been fine. And I do actually think the kind of cluster of attention that is being paid to these albums doesn't necessarily reflect like a resurgence of indie rock, but I do think there were a few years where poptimism, quote unquote, not a term I use, not a term I'm interested in, but things were getting pushed off to the side of the quote unquote discourse. And I do think indie rock has returned closer to the center of the discourse in the last 2 or 3 years. So I don't know that means that indie rock is back, but I think, Joe, to your point, conversation about indie rock does feel more pointed than it has really at any point in the last 5-10 years, really. And that's really striking.
Yeah, it's interesting that that has dovetailed with a return to that sound in the mainstream, whether it's the rise of pop punk or the fact that Harry Styles, as it was the biggest song of the year, sounds like The Strokes and Vampire Weekend, you know what I mean? And whatever you want to call the rise of indie sleaze or something being fit under that umbrella, like, I think we'll talk about this more probably in the coming year, but I will say, and I won't use names, but I went to a show recently that I would not have gone to on my own.
I know what you're talking about.
And I will just say the chief influence on the headlining band that I saw play a sold out show was Animal Collective, followed closely by a band called Battles. So where are my Battles heads at?
I have a good Battles t-shirt somewhere.
I wrote about Battles when I first got to the Times, which is a weird thing to remember.
Strange time.
So I just think, yeah, I think like you're right that it's never gone away, but the spotlight, I think, has slowly inched its way back to those things in response to, like you said, like an era which I think turned a lot of people off, where you were forced to think critically about Lady Gaga or whoever it was.
But in terms of this specific year end list, we just talked like 20 minutes ago about how so many big name albums landed with a bit of a thud this year. I think it just created space on these lists for all these writers to make arguments for these smaller albums and be like, well, it was better than the Post Malone album.
Which, like, we're not arguing with.
But that's also big 1992 energy. You know what I mean? That's big, like, early Spin magazine. That's Spin magazine energy, early 90s. That's Pitchfork, late 90s, early aughts energy. This kind of, we're rejecting the center of the pop conversation in favor of this kind of, like, always.
But it was a year where the center of pop wasn't necessarily performing at peak.
I do think we have made the argument in years past that the most popular stuff was also the most interesting stuff.
Yes. Yes.
For a period of time. And I think that I feel comfortable saying, like,
this year,
if
was
you're
not
talking
it.
About Harry Styles as the most popular stuff, it is not the most interesting stuff.
And also, I mean, frankly, out of the big pop records that made it onto my year end list and a lot of NJP's and Lindsay's, I think, like, Rosalia's the most interesting. But I even.
She's both.
But even Beyonce, like, the Beyonce album is very good, but I'm not sure it's as interesting or as, I'm not sure it's as much of a provocation as the Rosalia record, like from a stylistic and structural perspective. And so I do think, Joe, that's a point. I found myself arguing a lot in the early to mid 2010s that, like, incredibly popular rappers were also either the most avant-garde or the most thoughtful or the most lyrical or whatever. And people were just like, that's insane. Like, how could you say that? Then that became accepted. That's accepted discursive. That's the discourse. And now it's, nah, you know, people are going back to their Billy Woods records, you know, and holding tight to them. Shout out, Jason.
Yeah, it's also interesting. Yeah, it's interesting to see that in hip hop, too, because I think, you know, when you look at what rap made a lot of year end lists, it is often this sort of lo-fi underground. Yeah,
the Mavi, Billy Woods, etc. And again, it's like that stuff is good and interesting, but it also doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists like in discourse, even if in hostile discourse with the mainstream.
But these pendulum swings, yeah, are in full force. And I think whoever asked this question is right that the pendulum, I think, has moved back in that direction.
Karen, I'm going to go right back to you with another question.
Oh, God.
This last one specifically said they were a Ganscore fan. This is just a Ganscore question. This is from Edward Loera. Edward says, do we really think Madonna is hung up on Tokisha? For reals. The kinship between the two kind of makes sense in that Tokisha and her music embody a sexual liberation that Madonna pioneered. But seeing Madonna make out with Tokisha in the duo's music video and taking Tokisha to fashion shows feels creepy and less subversive than Madonna's past sexually liberated or sexually expressive work. What does the kinship between the two represent for each of their respective career arcs?
A marketing opportunity.
For both.
Yeah. Question is 100% right on. I was intrigued and then disappointed by that dragged out relationship, which seemed only in service of one remix and a Pride performance over the summer. You know, Madonna does this. Or whoever in Madonna's camp is advising her, you know, they'll put their finger on some young people who they think it's advisable for her to be in association with. I didn't have any like strong artistic vibes about the song or the hanging out or the making out or anything. It was all just sort of seemed like naked marketing to me. The song that they remixed was Hung Up and made a video. That original Hung Up video is probably my favorite Madonna video of all time. Everybody just go watch it right now. So that did not need to be touched.
What, better than La Isla Bonita?
I thought you were going to say better than Like a Prayer.
Better than Borderline? Like, really?
I don't think that Borderline is a great video. Mm-hmm. John is dancing just to give some alt text for what is happening right now. No, but the Hung Up video, you know, a later career, but not late career Madonna. We're talking about Confessions on a Dance Floor era. Pink leotard dancing across the studio, seemingly improvised, obviously highly choreographed. Truly one of the best videos ever made. So I was a little extra touchy about the remake because it was touching something that meant so much to me.
Damn.
Also, that song, another song, as I pointed out in my newsletter last week, built on a sample of another artist's song. That song is built on ABBA's Gimme, 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 A Man After Midnight, but totally reinvented. It's a perfect song. It was a perfect video. So I was a little touchy about it being retouched.
Do not play with Karen's Madonna fixations. Do not play.
So I might have felt...
Are you listening, Team Madonna? Are you listening? Do not play with Karen's Madonna fixations, please. We all suffer when you play with Karen's Madonna fixations.
I apologize. I had to add that. I got a little, I got a little emotional.
It's okay. This is a safe space for you to express your traumas. It's totally fine.
I know. You know I'm recording this sitting beneath a giant cover of the first ever issue of Spin, which had Madonna on it.
Wow.
Can you picture this cover? Are you familiar with this?
Yes, you're a benevolent saint.
Takesha could never.
Exactly.
I don't know about never, but, you know, couldn't yet. How about couldn't yet?
Fine.
It's been a weird year.
Pop stars be vampires. That, you know, it's a tried and true dynamic. And Karen, I know you're going pretty easy and fair, but been a weird year in Madonna.
Tough year.
It has been a weird year in Madonna. I will say,
jeez,
a hard year of Madonna in the larger world and on social media, but actually an exceptionally good year for Madonna in terms of archival releases, singles and stuff that people have been waiting for a really long time. So it's a bit of a wash. I'm a little concerned about next year. It's a little bit of a wait and see for me. But you know I love her.
I do know you love her. All right, quick question. Colin Chow wants to know thoughts on Yeats' staying power.
Okay, you know what has staying power? The Nobel's video about Yeats.
Yeah, that's the hilarious
that's the song part, of the year, probably.
That's the song of the year. Although I will say there is that funny part in the Complex story with Yeet where they show him the tweet or the IG post and he looks
that
at the numbers.
Incredible.
And he's like, that ain't viral. Which fair.
He dissected the premise of the question.
Seriously. He was like, that's not viral. Now, to be fair, that was viral perhaps in another medium or in aggregate, it was viral. Within our spheres, it was viral.
It was viral to
us. It was local viral.
The best kind of viral.
Yeah, to be honest, truly the preferable kind of viral. Yeah. But yes, Yeats' staying power. Here's what I think. I think if you look, broadly speaking, at the post-Cardi ecosystem, and I mean that in the kind of Destroy Lonely, Ken Carson segment.
Playboy, also, let's be
Playboy
clear.
Cardi. Playboy, yeah, Cardi. Sorry, not Cardi B. Playboy
with a
Cardi.
T, not a D. Yeah.
Yes, sorry. That Duncan refresher is complicating my syllabic pronunciation. So
just easily confused.
Yeah. That's fine. So if you look at the post Playboy Cardi ecosystem, Yeet being obviously an inheritor of that, what I'm struck by is that music seems to primarily exist for virality and quasi-virality and for live performances or, you know, raid shows, basically, right? It's almost like hardcore in a way. And so it doesn't really crack through. And also, these are rappers who are not getting on crossover tracks. They're not doing Dua Lipa songs. They're not doing Selena Gomez songs, at least not yet, or don't appear to want to do that. In a lot of ways, it's the logical extension of SoundCloud 1.0 or 2.0. This is where it's arrived, but it's almost, we're verging on atonal at this point. And I think as long as Yeet continues to do that, Yeet will be exactly where Yeet is. Is he talented enough to do a different thing? I think he probably is, but I don't know. There's a lot of lucre. Yeah, I see you. There's a lot of lucre doing this thing that he's doing. I think it's a TBD.
I think Yeet is a really instructive example about the going back to the first question about star making, which is, you know, the lack of hits and stars, I think, runs through this entire mailbag. And 5 years ago, they would have really tried to make Yeet a crossover mainstream star. Whether or not he would play ball is a question. But I think the paths available to rappers like Yeet and to, you know, rage music artists in general is you can be Playboy Cardi, you can refuse the mainstream, not collaborate with anybody bigger than you unless they're going to come to your world, you know, never put out your albums when you say you are, rely only on mystique and cult of personality and live shows, or you can become Travis Scott. And I think if you ask Yeet, do you want to be Travis Scott? What do you think he would say? I think he would say yes, but I don't know if he has the hits to do it.
I think he would say,
exactly.
I think he would say that. That concludes part one of the mailbag. There were so many questions. We're going to get to as many of them as possible in another part. Listen to every podcast ever, nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, tinyurl.com/podcast, Facebook or /podcast Discord to get in the conversation. Subscribe anywhere you get your audio content, Google, Apple, Stitcher, etc. Buy the t-shirts. It's thepopcast.myshopify.com. Karen, thank you. Joe, thank you. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. We will be back with part two of Popcast next week. Let's go out with some classic, crisp lyricism from Yeet. And then you answer, does Yeet have longevity? This is Crank.